Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Thursday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. David French of National Review is in for the vacationing Jim Garrity today. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today. And we're only going to spend one of them on Charlottesville today for the most part. I guess in some ways they all touch on it, but this is the one that deals specifically with it. And this is an interview that the relatively new chairwoman of the Republican National Committee, Ronna Romney McDaniel of Michigan, did with Good Morning America on Wednesday. David, you obviously have mentioned a couple of different times here in our sessions this week about your great disappointment with how President Trump has handled the response to the violence in Charlottesville this past weekend. So,
have I mentioned that? I thought that was like just subtext.
In passing, you know, in passing. Nothing nothing with too much detail. So anyway, Ronna Romney McDaniel, speaking with ABC, says that, first of all, the idea of equal blame here is not something that she agrees with. She was reluctant to put any blame really on the president, but she definitely made it clear she disagreed with that aspect of his statement from Tuesday.
First of all, we have to unequivocally say that the KKK and the white supremacists were wrong. I do think people may have showed up in Charlottesville thinking, hey, this is going to be a discussion about whether we remove historic statues. The second they saw Nazi flags, they should have turned tail. The second you join a group that has a Nazi flag or is joining the KKK, there's no good there. There's no good KKK member. There's no nice neo-Nazi. This is not a Republican or Democrat issue. This is un-American what they're doing.
And she made it very clear to those who align themselves with that ideology that they better look for a different political home than the GOP.
Our party has, across the board, said this is unacceptable. We have no place in our party at all for KKK, anti-Semitism, race, racism, bigotry. It has no place in the Republican Party. There is no home here. We don't want your vote. We don't support you. We'll speak out against you. The president has said so, the vice president, leaders across our party. This is the beginning of what needs to be a longer conversation. We are seeing this rhetoric ramp up. We are seeing more violence.
And David, the vast majority of Republicans have said things very similar to that. But to hear her say, we don't want you in the party, we don't want your votes, none of that stuff, that is certainly good to hear. But it's also very contrary to the mainstream media, which if you don't say exactly what they want you to say in denouncing the response, they try to lump you into the same category.
Well, right. I mean, you know, look, those are the words of a person who realizes that the Republican Party is going to exist, hopefully, for 100 years after Donald Trump has departed from the political scene. And there are some markers you just kind of got to lay down. You just got to say, absolutely, this is unacceptable. Absolutely, we do not want your vote. Absolutely, we're not defined by you in any way, shape, or form. We're not affiliated with you. We're completely distant and separate from you. And you just, these are words that just have to be said. And I would note, look, that's not hard to say. Like, that doesn't take the slightest bit of sort of moral courage. It just requires the, you know, an ounce of moral clarity to say that. And I'm glad she said it. That's awesome that she said it. It's imperative that she said it. But that's also somebody who's thinking down the line a little bit and realizes that that sort of mindless, reflexive defense of whatever Donald Trump says or does is not in the long-term best interests of the Republican Party, much less not, you know, not morally right and appropriate to defend the kinds of things that Trump said. And I'm glad she said what she said about it's, I don't care who you are, once you show up and you see the swastika, that's when you turn around and leave. When you say, nope, I'm out of here. I may be like a, say, let's say I'm a high school history teacher and I value, you know, the preserving this signs and symbols of the American past, and I'm there to make that statement as if anyone was actually in that crowd who was like that. But the instant you see that, you just say, nope, not my team, not my crowd, I'm out of here. And you know, look, these are just basic, very basic things, but they needed to be said, they had to be said. Very glad she said them.
David, let's move on to the bad martini now, our second martini of the day. And this is from the pages of the American Prospect. I'm sure you've got that one bookmarked on your browser all the time. It's a kind of a left-leaning site, to say the least. They're usually pretty harsh towards Trump and Republicans and conservatives, but they're kind of protectionist when it comes to trade, and they agree with the Trump wing on trade. And so Steve Bannon returned their phone call and decided to talk about a lot of different things, which is raising some eyebrows, perhaps most of all that it was on the record, or at least he didn't say that it was off the record. So kind of in the same mold as Anthony Scaramucci, we got a conversation very much made public, and whether or not Bannon wanted it to be public, we don't know. But in this conversation, he talks about a number of different things, which not only lays out what you would think would be internal strategy, but also different areas where he's clearly at odds with at least the publicly stated position of the Trump administration on a number of things. It's clear in this article written by Robert Kuttner that an economic trade war with China is at the top of the Bannon agenda. He says, quote, "We're at economic war with China. It's in all their literature. They're not shy about saying what they're doing. One of us is going to be a hegemon in 25 or 30 years, and it's going to be them if we go down this path. On Korea, they're just tapping us along. It's a sideshow." Here's more of what he said about North Korea. "There's no military solution. Forget it. Until somebody solves the part of the equation that shows me that 10 million people in Seoul don't die in the first 30 minutes from conventional weapons, I don't know what you're talking about. There's no military solution here. They got us." Bannon went on to describe his battle inside the administration to take a harder line on China trade and not to fall into a trap of wishful thinking in which complaints against China's trade practices now had to take a back seat to the hope that China, as an honest broker, would help to restrain Kim Jong-un. "To me," Bannon said, "the economic war with China is everything, and we have to be maniacally focused on that. If we continue to lose it, we're 5 years away, I think 10 years at the most, of hitting an inflection point from which we'll never be able to recover." He goes on to say that his plan of attack is a complaint under Section 301 of the 1974 Trade Act against Chinese coercion of technology transfers from American corporations doing business there, which a lot of people believe is a legitimate complaint about the Chinese stranglehold on American tech. He says, "We're going to run the tables on these guys. We've come to the conclusion that they're in an economic war and they're crushing us." He also talks about the personnel wars that's going on in the State Department and elsewhere, about needing to get hawks in there on East Asia and not the establishment folks. When it comes to Charlottesville, he was asked about that briefly. Quote, "He dismissed the far right as irrelevant and sidestepped his own role in cultivating it, saying, quote, ethno-nationalism, it's losers. It's a fringe element. I think the media plays it up too much, and we got to help crush it, you know, help crush it more. These guys are a collection of clowns." But as it pertains to the Democrats making a big issue out of identity politics, he's all for that. Quote, "The Democrats," he said, "the longer they talk about identity politics, I got them. I want them to talk about racism every day. If the left is focused on race and identity and we go with economic nationalism, we can crush the Democrats." So, David, I'm guessing there's different portions of our audience that'll like some of that, not like some of that. Others will wonder why he's going public and whether this will finally be the last nail in his coffin inside the White House as a strategist for the president. What's your takeaway?
Well, I mean, regardless of what you think of the substance, there's an element of this that's just kind of nuts. I mean, so here we have the chief strategist to the president of the United States, Republican president of the United States, calling a pretty far left journalist, apparently just thinking he's going to shoot the breeze with him, and then divulging sort of all of this kind of dirty laundry about how he views politics within the administration, without asking that it be off the record. And the reports I'm seeing is that he was as surprised as anyone to see this, you know, to see the story made public, which I have to say would surprise me if he's surprised. Like, whatever you want to say about Steve Bannon, no one's accused him of not being a media savvy person. So this is all so crazy to think about it, to have, you know, once again, another senior advisor in the Trump administration calling a journalist who's known to be on the left and absolutely just sort of airing out that dirty laundry. It's an amazing development, really. And as far as the substance goes, he absolutely undermined the president on North Korea. He absolutely undermined him. And the problem is, he did so in a way that was ridiculously exaggerated. I mean, he talked about millions of people dying almost instantly due to conventional weapons. Well, that's not the case. I mean, the situation is serious enough, but he magnified it considerably. And then he acted as if it's up to him who works in this administration. that, you know, he's going to engineer hiring and firing. And so it really was a remarkable moment. I mean, what he essentially did is he sort of said, what Bannon said is, here are the arguments, or what Bannon appeared to be doing was saying, hey, I'm just going to call this left-wing journalist and just spill to him the arguments that I make inside the administration and air them out. And, you know, a disciplined administration does not do that. A disciplined administration would not have twice in a row, twice in 2 to 3 weeks, the same kind of incident. I mean, it really is extraordinary when you back up a minute and you go, let's just back up and see what actually happened here. As far as the merits of the claim, you know, look, it's welcome to see him say that ethno-nationalists are losers, but Breitbart did more than anybody else in the United States of America to give them a platform and a respectable hearing. His own Milo Yiannopoulos wrote the single most widely shared, influential article, which then launched a million media appearances, presenting an apologetic for some of these same people that he now calls losers. So sorry, not buying it. But anyway, you go. Let's just go back to the original thought here. What the heck is going on? I mean, who's going to call next? I mean, are you going to, you know, Stephen Miller calling the editor in chief of HuffPo and airing out his views? I mean, this is crazy.
Well, he thought he had some common cause on trade, I guess, more with the Bernie Sanders wing of the left than anybody else. They thought they could win over Sanders supporters on that issue, particularly after the revelations from how the DNC treated Bernie Sanders last year. I don't know if there was a lot of evidence. Did they get some?
Yeah, they did win some. I mean, it's funny. This is just anecdotal, but I can remember multiple conversations that I had with stereotypical Bernie bros who expressed that they definitely liked Donald Trump more than Hillary Clinton, in large part because of the trade issues, because of the economic populism. So I think there was, you know, I don't know if it was statistically significant, but hey, I've talked to people who were Bernie bros who pulled the lever for Donald Trump. They do actually exist.
Wow. So given what we've seen this week from the responses to Charlottesville and now this interview by Bannon, David, was this supposed to be Infrastructure Week? I can't remember.
Who even knows? Infrastructure Week, Manufacturing Week. I think we've had multiple weeks at this point, and I don't think I can remember a single one of them.
They always start off with an event, but usually by Monday afternoon or certainly by Tuesday, something has happened that we're not really spending a lot of time talking about it anymore.
I think every week should be just Twitter week.
Obviously, given what we've seen in the last few days, the media is on the hunt for Republicans to condemn, Republicans to support Trump. They'll pretty much put the Republicans on the spot in any way that they can. And now it appears one of the media's favorite Republicans from the 2016 cycle is inching closer to a 2020 primary challenge for Donald Trump. Willie Geist over at NBC tweeted this. New sources close to @JohnKasich tell me, after Charlottesville, there is a growing sense of moral imperative to primary Trump in 2020. Hat tip to Hot Air for that. And David, this is an anecdotal. This is my own inbox. I got an email from John Kasich for America today highlighting his appearance on the Today Show. And it's the same website that he had during the campaign. It still has all of his platform positions, talking about a positive vision for America. He's term limited, so he's not running for governor again. It's obvious he's not running for Senate. So John Kasich has more than a toe in the water here for 2020. He made it clear during the 2016 campaign that he would not vote for and would not endorse Donald Trump. So a lot of folks who don't like Trump are loving the idea of a primary challenge because they know in recent political history, that has not bode well for the incumbent, whether it's Jimmy Carter or George H.W. Bush or what have you. But the idea of John Kasich getting traction in 2020 when he couldn't get traction anywhere other than Ohio in 2016 seems like a giant pipe dream, and somebody needs to talk this guy down.
Yeah, I don't think there's anybody in America right now outside of the Kasich camp who's saying, I've got a fever, and the only cure is more Kasich. This is a guy, let's not forget, who is in many ways played a significant role in the rise of Donald Trump in this sense, and that as the primary continued to narrow and as it was extremely clear that he could not win, he stayed in and continued to shave off 20-25% of the vote here and there, when it should have been a one-on-one affair between Trump and Ted Cruz. And he just kept staying in. He kept hanging in there. I think, hoping and believing somehow that there would be a brokered convention, and that in a brokered convention, the people would rise up and select him. So, you know, in a lot of ways, I look back at 2016 and I think, well, among the million different things that happened that helped facilitate this black swan event of the rise of Trump, one of them was a lot of these primary contenders staying in the race longer than they should have because they just couldn't quite believe that Trump would stay in and win. And so people hung in there. They clung to their position in the race well beyond the point where normally they would have bowed out. And it's one of the reasons why we have Donald Trump, a man who became the Republican nominee with the lowest percentage of the Republican primary vote of any nominee in the open primary era. And now he's coming back for a second bite of the apple. And I could easily imagine a situation where you had a conservative challenger to Trump and John Kasich. And here comes John Kasich once again carving out 10, 15, 20% of the electorate. But look, we're still a long ways away. At this point, I'd be surprised if Kasich didn't run. I think he's a likely primary challenger. The question is, will there be anybody else?
Yeah, and let's not forget what John Kasich has done since Election Day. He was out there basically trashing every single Obamacare repeal and reform proposal out there, and not because he didn't think they were conservative enough. He kept talking about how they were unfair and cruel and how we weren't reaching across the line. So if you think John Kasich is the one to restore fundamental conservative principles in Washington or anywhere else, probably not going to happen.
Yeah, and I don't think he'd run in that way either. I think he would run and say, look, run basically on the basis of I'm a decent human being and this guy Donald Trump is not. And the thing about that, though, is that's kind of the whole approach that's been taken against Trump from the beginning, and it hadn't worked yet. Now, again, after 36 months more of what we've been enduring for the last six, will Trump's mystique be gone? I think it would be, but if it is gone by that point, then it will be more than John Kasich in the field.
A lot to look forward to, but hey, we still got over a year to go before the midterm, so everybody stay patient. David, always good to have you with us. We'll talk again tomorrow.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
David French of National Review in for the vacationing Jim Garrity today. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us, and tune in again on Friday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.